This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Dave King.
Hi, Joan.
Hi. Dave is, well, I know you as an artist and the king of spoken word. And you're, to me, you're a natural raconteur. When I saw you this Friday up at the Exchange, you had the audience in the palm of your hand, as usual.
Well, thank you very much, Joan. It didn't feel like it.
Oh, no. Well, it certainly sounded like it. And every time I hear you, I'm just totally in the where you are. You know, you take me to that place. Have you had any drama training?
Only life experiences, I guess.
Well, I think that's the very best kind, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah. So I know you've done a lot of writing. Like I say, you perform a lot of spoken word. Was there any, before you got to this point, what other jobs have you done? Where else have you been?
To be quite truthful with you, John, I think I've had about 300 to 400 different kinds of jobs.
Yeah.
I left school at 14. I started travelling when I was 15. Went all around Europe. Ended up in Miami for a couple of years. And everything from washer-up, waiter, working for an oil company with waste oil. That was quite a funny one. Joan got shot at a few times there.
Shot at? And you survived, clearly?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Was it personal, or was you just in the wrong place at the wrong time?
One was an accident. One was working in Liberty City, which is... I used to work Liberty City and Carroll City, which is in Miami. They're all black areas.
Right.
And so being a little white boy, didn't really go down too well in some parts. I was working for Pyramid Sales out the back of my car.
That probably didn't help, did it?
No. And then on a Saturday, I used to be working with, there used to be a black guy, me being the white guy, and a Cuban. So I was the spieler. One was the driver, and the other one used to get them to the van. And then we'd open up our van and sell our wares, being costume, jewellery, jewels, tools, whatever. So that was quite that was quite a hair-raising experience. And then there was another time.
So you learnt a lot of life skills there.
Oh, a lot. Yeah.
How to save your own life.
How to go and live somewhere else, Joan. To be quite truthful, that's why I think
totally different culture.
Back to the island, yeah. Yeah, totally different. Yeah, gun crazy. I mean, even my wife had a 22 in a handbag, and she was only 17 years of age. So
was that just for protection, presumably?
Oh, yeah.
Because you had to. Did you have a gun?
No, I wouldn't. No, it was like going back to when I was a kid. It's the same as carrying a knife. If you were, you know, I was always taught if you brought your knife out, you better make sure that you use it, otherwise you're going to get it used on yourself.
Exactly.
So best not to carry.
So it's more dangerous to have one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they normally shoot themselves more than they shoot anyone else.
So how long did you sustain that for?
Oh, just a couple of years. A
couple of years?
Yeah.
And what was your hairiest moment?
My hairiest moment was getting arrested and then ended up in Dade County for 5 days on a felony charge on a grand auto theft, and not just the game.
No. Oh, the original grand auto theft.
Yeah, that was a nasty one. I was parking cars at the time. Incredible story, really. I got a job as a car valet person.
Yeah.
Working in the afternoon. And one day, the guy said to me, "Oh, would you like to work a Saturday evening?" And I thought, yeah, great. So there I am, working, parking cars out of a steak restaurant in South Miami. Come about 1:30 in the morning. It's thinning out now. It's a very popular place, you know, 300 or 400 people. Massive place. And there's down, I think there were 6 valet car parks, and now I'm working with a young guy who was younger than me. I was about 25 at the time. This guy's about 17. Still remember his name. His name was Chris. He ended up just me and him working. And I remember when I parked my car opposite in a garage that I left my lights on. So obviously I was going to have a flat battery.
Yeah.
So I said to Chris, "Look, the next car we get in, do you mind if we just nip round and jumpstart my car?" So the young lad, all of a sudden this other car came in, this incredible brand new Corvette. And anyway, cut a long story short, which I often do, we jumped in, we got round to my car. Before we got round there, I noticed that we'd been clocked by a police car. They pulled us up. One thing led to another, all screaming and shouting. They'd done a check on him. They found out that he was on an armed robbery charge out on reconnaissance to his mother. Then all hell broke loose. Then the guy came out of the restaurant whose car it was. He turned out to be a lawyer. He was half cut. He went for the guy. I'm trying to explain to the police at the time, look, he's 17 years of age. He's in the car. Of course, he's going to be just drove it around the block a bit too fast. I was told to shut up, mind my own business, get back in the car. And that was it. And next thing I know...
And that's by the police. The police told you to.
The police told me to do that, yeah. Next thing I know, they've taken me down to their local police station at first. And I'll never forget, they had a German Shepherd there. And I love dogs. I started stroking the dog. And then all of a sudden, they said a command and the dog sort of started growling its teeth. And the guy grabbed hold of it and put it right up to my face. And I thought to myself, oh, not much reasoning here with the American police. I think I'd better not say anything at all. And then I ended up in another police station called Day County, of where immigration came on to me, asked me thousands of questions. They charged me on a felony charge because they found out that in this particular restaurant, two or three cars have been taken, you know, very expensive Mercedes or whatever, yeah. And they thought that I was part of a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And there I am in black trousers and a white shirt just trying to earn a few bob parking cars.
Dave.
I know, strip searched, warned that if I do go upstate, straight out of the movies, that I had no chance.
You can't mess with the American police, can you?
You can't say anything.
No.
I mean, I do believe the only qualifications you need is actually to know someone in the police force, a cousin or something, and there you go. No, you can't miss. They are so paranoid. It's
And you're guilty before being proven innocent,
absolutely,
aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I had to go through the whole rigmarole of going to court, telling them all the stories. Just unbelievable. In the end, what happened? In the end, I think I had to phone up. I did. I had to phone up once a week for 6 months to tell them what I'm doing, where I am, and all the rest of
it. Like a sort of probation?
Kind of, yeah. But I had to go through all this rigmarole. Yeah. I'll say the felony charge was... that carried a 2 to 5 year sentence as well. And I'm thinking, you've got to be joking here.
No, you couldn't.
I'm parking bloody cars.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was an experience that I never forget. One of them.
Yeah, but looking at you, I mean, you haven't got a scar or a brack on you, so you obviously managed to duck and dive.
Yeah.
A great survivor.
Well, and also, Joan, you probably know yourself that the worst scars are the ones that are hidden.
Oh, well, yes, for sure.
So,
for sure.
Yeah, I've been lucky. Green, naive, that's what I've always been. I always say to myself, you know, my naivety that has got me out of these got me in these situations. Incredible, yeah, madness.
But I think naivety is great because you feel no fear, do you?
No.
And so in the sense that I think it's great is just to explain that, you then leap perhaps where somebody who's a little bit older and wiser would see the shortcomings,
sure,
and not take that risk. But when you're naive and green, you just go for it, don't you? So sometimes great things can come of that.
Sure.
And you must have had times where, like you say, your naivety in your youth was on your side and you tried something that perhaps you wouldn't do now you're a bit older and wiser.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure.
You were telling me before we came on air that you had a practice in Harley Street as a therapist.
Yeah, I thought to myself, oh, well, I wonder if I could actually find a place and get into Harley Street as a kind of psychotherapist, because the brain has always interested me. So I managed to get online to an online college that done these diplomas, degrees, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Psychology.
Was this a printing press out the back, Dave?
It could have been. It was something like that. But I did have a few bits and pieces. And then I found a place in Harley Street, which was owned by a Russian concern. And I don't think they were too bothered
about who was going in
who
there.
I was.
And what you were doing.
Or what I was, no.
Okay.
But then I had a bit of a guilty conscience, apart from my wife managing to secure a part-time position up there with guaranteed money per day. It was all a bit forced, So I decided not to go through with it, not to sign the lease, even though. But I still ended up with, you know, my my diplomas in psychology.
And have you used them, put them to good use?
Oh, I believe I put them to good use, yeah. I think it helped me when I went to work for the Samaritans. That helped me a lot.
How long did you work for the Samaritans?
Just under 5 years, yeah, in all roles. As
so
a listener,
would
foremost.
Call you in the middle of the night?
Any time, yeah. You know, because the Samaritans, 24/7.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful organisation. A wonderful movement, actually. 60-odd years now. Incredible story. I mean, I could even tell you about the guy that started it up and all his life as well. And he was certainly an eccentric. I mean, he went around the world helping to open up centres for people to offload,
yeah,
basically. Someone to listen. I never thought I could listen, Joan. I know you probably don't think yourself. I mean, no one else does. I didn't actually think that I could listen.
And it's this anonymity, isn't it, that you ring and nobody knows who you are and you don't know who you're talking to at the end of the phone.
No, we're not interested in names. Mm. You know, you can call us what you like. Call yourself Mickey Mouse if you want.
Mm.
And that's the greatest thing. No other service does that. They always want to know too much and pass the information on to social services. Not that that's not a good thing. Of course, it's a good thing. But, yeah,
this gives people that freedom and trust,
doesn't
it? Yes,
it does. Yeah.
So when you were there taking the calls at midnight and through the night, in those, what are people's often darkest hours, aren't they, when everything seems so bleak?
When they're at the end of the tether.
Yeah, and you were there picking up those calls. I mean, how did that make you feel?
I looked at it as soon as you came in and started your shift. It really was, you change into that mode.
Yeah.
And it's not about my feelings, it was about the caller's feelings.
It's a tremendous sense of responsibility, though.
It is. I mean, the greatest thing that they do, that after your shift is finished, you offload to a colleague on the phone.
Oh, I see.
And hopefully that colleague will ask you the right questions if any of the calls disturbed you.
I think,
of course, it's going to touch some nerves.
So you're almost counselled after your session yourself?
Yes, straight away. And I found that hard in the beginning. I would take it all home and start offloading to my wife until she turned around one day and said to me, for God's sake, stop this, you know. And then I did, and then I started putting my trust in my colleagues. And that took me a little while to offload, because, you know.
And that feeling, though, that you have helped somebody at when they're on the brink of the, like I said, the darkest moment of their life, that you've managed to pull them back, that must be amazing.
It is, yeah. It's satisfactory.
And do you feel that in... Have you felt that in the call, that there has actually been that turning point?
It's like when the penny drops.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people beat around the bush to what they really have phoned up for. They could tell you all sorts of stories, and you've got to try to pick out what they're really getting at. And at the end of the day, every call, we always ask every caller, have you ever contemplated taking your own life? And then normally, as soon as we say that, then it's either a yes or no. And then we work it from there.
Because people don't have to be at that point, do they?
No, they don't.
They can just be feeling low and want somebody
just
to listen.
Just want someone to talk to. I mean, we're isolated. Unfortunately, we're so isolated these days. Families have been broke up. You have sons and daughters living in all different parts of the world. We're isolated. We hardly even talk to our neighbours. So just have a phone call, and there's also a free phone now, which has just come in this last couple of years as well, which is absolutely fantastic. So it doesn't even cost you any money. Just to phone up and to speak to speak to someone who's going to understand and just listen to what you got to say.
Do you get people who ring in regularly?
Oh, for years. Yeah, there's been regular callers phoning for the last 20 years.
Yeah. And so, really, they just want a friend, a long-term friend? Is that how they see it?
Yeah. I mean, Samaritans have changed over the course of the years. You know, once upon a time, when it first started, we used to go out to the clients, in, you know, meet them in a cafe or meet them somewhere. We don't do that now for obvious reasons. But the policies are basically the same.
Which know. Are?
Oh, just to listen. I mean, we do get a lot of crank calls or sexual calls.
And you have to treat those, I guess, initially. You don't know they're crank until they...
No. And you can be there for 20 years and still make mistakes and still be taken up the garden path.
Yes.
In some horrific instances. I mean, you know, I've talked to colleagues and been working a shift with a colleague where they've been taken down the path 6 months ago by a supposed suicide, and then the person's recognised a person on the phone in that shift. So we get, you know, a few psychopaths sometimes.
I suppose it's going to attract that, isn't it?
Yeah, very rarely. I mean, on the whole, fantastic, you know, but there's always a percentage.
Yeah, like in any area of life.
Yeah, and they need something at the end of the day.
Of course.
So...
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything online? Now everything's online. So are the Samaritans, do they offer a service online where you don't phone up, where
sure.
you just put your question in online, or doesn't it work like that?
Yeah, well, we started, again, a few years ago, doing emails, and then we started doing text. So in quite a few of the offices, we have a text service, and that goes all out, you know, all over the world. Again, the texts obviously are from a younger generation, and they are horrific, especially the ones coming out of America. Absolutely horrific, some of the stuff that's going on.
Like what?
Oh, just wanting to end their life. We're talking about 15, 16, 17 year olds that have been abused, multiple abused by whoever, living out in the sticks in some parts of the States. Lots of stuff from Africa as well.
And how can you reach out and help, really help them?
Again, Joan, it's just a matter of, obviously texting back so the person knows that there's someone there.
Someone who cares.
Be for a text, be for an email. I mean, an email's a bit different because that's sort of like a 12-hour gap, or it can be. But with a text, as you know, it's instantaneous. So,
And that helps them, does it? That's all they need? Or?
Well,
do you put them in touch with other agencies?
We do now. We never used to.
Yeah.
But we do now. We're sort of linking up with more agencies.
If they want that help.
If they want that help, like Childline, for instance. I mean, Childline, I don't know if it's changed now, but Childline used to be open from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock, which means if you've got a problem after 5 o'clock, it really wasn't going to help you. I don't know if they've extended their service now, but everyone can only do what they can with the funds available. And as you probably can gather, funds are always needed to run these
and presumably volunteers needed.
Without volunteers, it wouldn't work. I mean, the Samaritans, that they give a minimum of 3.5 to 4 hours a week plus, because then you also, you don't just become a listener, you can become a trustee, you can become a leader, and a leader is a person that stays at home and receives the calls from the listeners to offload.
And how long do you spend in training before you're allowed to take those key calls?
Okay, if my reflecting back, I think it was something like a 9-week training, and then you work with a mentor until that's normally about 7 to 10 hours on top with the phone call. You're just listening in and you're working with a mentor. So, and if the mentor thinks that you're ready, it could be after 7 hours or a little bit longer.
Okay.
Some need a little bit more. Those that have been working in schools or some role of authority take a little bit longer. to learn to listen.
I see. But it must be quite an intense process, that training.
It is a tense, yeah. I mean, there's an introductory day where we sort of weed those out that have any prejudice, you know, being homophobic or being a bit racist or being a bit, which is a natural thing inside of us anyway, but we can explain it in a different way. So then we do some role playing. So let's say out of a group of 30 that start, we probably knock that down to about 20, and then that sort of fiddles down to about 4 or 5. Because they drop off.
Yes.
They find some of it.
Very intense, I would think.
It's very intense, yeah. I mean, if you're going to get a caller and the person, let's say the person is a paedophile and they're looking at children and they're saying to you things and they're trying to take you down a dark passage, which a lot try to, it does take a certain kind of person to be able to
deal with that.
To deal with it, yeah. I mean, how do you deal with it?
That must be so, how do you deal with it?
Well, there's some things you have to block off in your head. There's some things where if you're on an end of life call, for instance, and this is quite rare, but I think out of the calls that I had, I used to mark them down probably once a quarter. I would get a,
so this is somebody with a terminal illness.
This is someone with terminal illness, or someone that's just taken an overdose, or someone's in the process of hanging themselves, or whatever.
Oh, goodness.
But they're dying. Some people
are
in and out of consciousness. Nothing you can do.
You're just there.
In and out. No, you don't call an ambulance. You don't ask nothing. Only if they want. So even at their last breath, and you can say, "Would you like to phone an ambulance?" But then again, you see, if they can phone you, they can phone an ambulance.
Of course.
So everyone has the right to their own life, but they also have the right to their own death as well.
That must be... I can't imagine what it would be like to take a call like that.
No, it is horrendous, yeah. It's horrendous. And then you might need a little bit more help yourself after that call, because it will stay with you. It will stay with you.
And when you go home... at the end of a shift and you've had to field a call like that and you have been there in that
a good brandy, Joan. Yeah.
And somebody's listened to you, I would imagine.
No, you can't take it home.
No,
you've got to offload that, you know, to your upline, to your leader, or if it is that bad, then, and then you can go through it again with a few more colleagues.
Having worked at the Samaritans for a number of years,
yeah,
and having spoken to all sorts of people, really,
listen to them, Joan.
Yeah,
listen to them.
Yeah, and you do talk, you speak as well, don't you? Not just a listening wall.
Lot of the calls, you know, we can get a lot of calls, and it goes like this:
and that's you.
And at the end of it, they say, "Thank you very much. You've been so helpful. Thank you." And you haven't said nothing at all.
But you've listened.
Because what's happening, when you're giving people the space in their own head, then suddenly things work out. Options come.
Yeah.
All we do is give options. We don't give advice. We never tell anyone, you know, "Well, you should do this, you should do that," because no one will ever take that on board, and you shouldn't even go there. We just give options. "Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that?" Because when you are in crisis of any kind, it doesn't matter. Everyone's got their different crisis. Your cat can die, your goldfish can die. It can be a big thing to some people. Just give them the space. Give them the space in their head, and they will work out. The mind's an incredible thing, Joan. It will work out a solution for you to wake up the next day and to keep going on.
Yeah, and I imagine to have got to the point where they've made the call to the Samaritans, that's a big thing on their part, isn't it? It's a very brave thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And to admit that they are at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that takes a little bit of coaxing sometimes as well, you know.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that insight. So please stay tuned, and there'll be more from Dave King after the break, and we'll be hearing more from what Dave did next. Okay, speak to you in a minute. Bye-bye.
social and get in touch. It's /Vectis Radio on Facebook. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Wisdom, Wit and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest, Dave King.
Thanks, Joan. Welcome back.
So we're going to lift the mood a little bit, and I think you've got a poem or a reading about your mum's cat.
Yes. Yeah, mum was very strange, or the cats always used to end up very strange with mother.
Right. So she had that kind of fluence on them?
Well, I would call it nicotine smoker.
Right, OK, so that had an adverse effect on the cats.
I do believe so.
OK, yes. Take it away though, Dave.
All right. David! I knew it was bad news straight away by the urgency in her voice. Yes, Mother, I'm coming. What's happened? Snowy's dead, she said. Oh dear, this must be the third or fourth cat that has died throughout my life living with my mother. They all seem to die after having some kind of fit. It's very strange. Could it be something in the clouds of cigarette smoke or the deafening sound of Coronation Street come EastEnders music that blares out from the TV most nights? Makes you think. So after a few tears and whys, she said, David, please bury Snowy outside near the steps. OK, Mum, I said. In my softest voice. I can't really explain why, but on that day, things weren't going to plan. Nothing seems to be working either outside of my head or inside of it. And as for burying the cat, well, there's hardly any greenery outside, and what space there is, the dogs would surely dig it up. So I found a bin liner, put Snowy inside, and jumped into my car. Not really thinking of where I was going with him. I drove around a bit until suddenly I saw a skip. I made sure no one was looking and quickly put the bag underneath whatever was on top of the skip. I was back at the house in under 10 minutes. I put some gardening gloves on, walked back into Mother's lounge and said, Mum, all done? I'm going to get a rose tree and plant it in remembrance of Snowy. She looked at me with those Park Lane, beautiful blue eyes, even though I knew she was a bit, well, more than a bit blind, and hopefully could not read the guilty expression upon my face. Thank you, David. You're a good boy. A week or so passed, and I was in my local pub, having a drink, as you do in a pub, when I spotted a familiar face in the corner. It was too late to turn away. He saw me. Dave! He shouted, gesturing me to come over. Hello, Ted, I said. Now, Ted was a cross between Cat Weasel and someone who you would imagine has just escaped from a high-security mental institution. How you diddling, Dave? I noticed that he held his glass half-empty towards me with that look of please buy me a beer on it. Want a drink, Ted? So Ted starts to explain all his pains and troubles to me, and I'm looking around to see if I can catch someone so I can escape from him, until I hear the word skip pop into my brain. What, Ted? I said. He carried on rumbling on about something or another. I'm all ears now. So you know, Dave, I'm searching in this skip for things, and then all of a sudden I find this black bin liner. Before we finished the sentence, visions of the cat were appearing in my mind. Yes, Ted. God. Oh, he said. When I opened it up, there was this terrible stink and some kind of animal was in it. It freaked me out so much that I threw it as hard as I could over my shoulder. I wasn't really listening to any more of his ramblings. My mind was a blank. Never found anything either. All that mess and muck. For what, Dave, eh? What? Dave, where are you going? Sorry, Ted. Running late. See you later. More time passed, and I was due to play darts at the British Legion on a Monday night, roughly about a week after I last spoke to Ted. During my game of darts, I couldn't help but notice that my mother's cleaner, Wendy, was sitting with her boyfriend, Don, avoiding any eye contact with myself. This was strange. I started to think if maybe I had annoyed her or him in some way. Maybe it was that thrashing I gave Don at darts the last time we met. Couldn't for the life of me think of anything else. After my game of darts, which I'm sure I must have won, I wandered over to Wendy and Don and said, "Hello." Not much of a response from them. Very unusual. We're not the greatest of friends, but not enemies either. "What's wrong with you then?" I said, looking straight at Wendy. "Had a bad day." She turned her face slightly to one side like a mad Rottweiler who's just about to attack. "What's wrong with me?" she shouted. I'm thinking, yes, what's wrong with you? She starts to open her mouth once again, now looking at me menacingly, her eyes like burning pieces of coal. I'm sure she's foaming at the mouth. I was in my garden on Saturday morning when I found a bin liner scattered all over the place. Oh no, this can't be happening. And your mum's cat inside. I glanced quickly at Don's face, not a happy bunny, and again at hers, now with the expression on her face. "You so-and-so, I'm going to kill you," written all over it. "It, Wendy, Don," I said in my humblest voice possible. "Please let me explain."
Dave.
I know. I mean, once was bad enough, but twice?
I know.
On the same cat? And my mother's cleaner?
Oh.
Is that fate?
It's coincidence, isn't it?
Of course. It's more than that, Joan. It's more than that.
It's serendipity.
I know. I never did tell Mum.
Did they not tell her?
No. No, I don't think... No. No. I know. I know. It was bad. It was
bad. It's a good job it didn't have nine lives and come back and to haunt you, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah. 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 It was funny.
Because they say coincidence doesn't really happen, don't they?
Yeah.
But it's everywhere all the time. It's part of the fabric of our lives, isn't it?
Yeah, it keeps on. All this is floating around in the consciousness, isn't it? And all these particles that we are made up of, we're all made up of the same material. So it's just like space, and sometimes little particles meet now and then.
Yeah,
and then we get these things called coincidences.
The bit that got me in that story, well, it all got me, and it's a great story, very well told, but. Even though it's about a cat, it has a feel of a bit of a Shaggy Dog story about it as well.
Yeah.
But I like the bit where you actually had the thought to put gardening gloves on.
I know. It's a bit calculating, isn't it?
It is a bit. It's a bit.
I know. It's a bit calculating.
It's
a bit,
got a bit touched the psychopath there, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah.
To have that double think.
Yeah, it's a bit Brookside in that patio.
Whoa, you're going back a few years.
I am.
My friend was the actress who played the girl that...
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah, oh, wicked. Yeah. Wicked.
But, yes, see, I don't know. Like you say, there's a lot of planning went into that. That was a real attention to detail, wasn't
it? Yeah, well, Mum's a bit shrewd, you know.
Bit Dr. Crippen, though.
Well, we've all got a bit of Jekyll and things in us, haven't we?
But she was your mum. She knew you inside out.
Absolutely.
I'm surprised you could get anything past her.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I think she was knocking on 90 then, Joan C.
Yeah. So just taking advantage of an old lady.
Well, basically.
So as you went through, I mean, you must have been a handful. You really must.
Yeah, but she only had to put up with me for 14 years, didn't she? Because I left. Well, 15 years.
But they were probably the longest 15 years of her life, I would imagine.
I don't think she even knew I was there, John.
So were you an only child?
I was an only child, yeah.
Why was that? Because...
I'll tell you why, Joan. She was 44 when she had me.
And were you a bit of a pleasant surprise?
I think, yeah, she used to tell me that I had a bit of a big head, so I couldn't come out naturally, so she had to have a cesarean. I think the doctors told her that would be quite dangerous to have another one.
Oh, I see.
She told me that I was a miracle child, Joan, a miracle child. But then again, in the same breath, she used to say to me, "You should have been strangled at birth." So I couldn't quite make it out. Yes. It's true.
Well, I don't know. I think that sums
up... Confusing for me.
Yeah, but that sums up those both sides of your character, I think, doesn't it?
Both sides of my mother's character as well.
And what about your dad?
My dad was what I would call a diamond geezer, my dad. He was a worker. He was a worker. And my mother was an entrepreneur, but my dad was a worker. And he believed in the work ethic, and he loved his job. You know, he used to say to me, it's like being on the stage. And my dad worked in some of the biggest and greatest hotels and restaurants.
What was his job?
He ended up as a restaurant manager
right.
in some of the best ones, Trocadero, Thousand Park, Albion. Yeah, very respected man. I remember one of his clients died once. It was in the local paper. I left my dad 300 quid in his will, thanking him for the service. So he was a very well respected man in Brighton.
Well thought of, yeah.
Yeah.
And it is, I think it is, when you're a barman or a bar person or a manager, you are in front of the public. So in this sense, you have always got a paint on the smile, haven't you?
Oh, you bring always back performing. A memory. My dad used to come back with his hands clenched and fists of rage, Joan, because he'd get some people that are coming in that have been saved up all week for a meal and they couldn't tell a steak from corned beef.
Right.
So what can he do? He's always got to say yes. The English don't really make that good workers in the service industry. My father only used to employ, you know, French, Italian, Spanish, because he said to me they're much better. Hard workers, yeah. And they're used to the service industry.
So what attributes do you think you've got from your father?
Well, I could say one thing, Joan, but that'd be rude. What have I got?
Do you think you've got his work ethic?
It's a bit of a question. Now, you see, on the other hand, I can always remember my dad saying to me, he said, David, work is only for fools and horses. And I sort of gave that quite a mulling over. Yeah, it's only for fools and horses. Who says we have to work? Why can't I just grow my potatoes and eat them and do nothing every day? He tells me I've got to work. It's only those that want to make money off you that tell you you've got to work. No one's really got to work, if you really think about it. All right, you've got to toil the land, but that's because you're working for your food.
Yes.
You don't have to do that anymore.
I think the 9-to-5 grind, you know, 5 days a week, we are, you know, more flexible working and working at home. That's, and job sharing, all is, that landscape is changing a little, isn't it?
It's got worse, isn't it, really? It's got worse. Even they brought in the flexi hours and all the rest of it, people are actually working more now. Whatever happened to Ted Heath's 3-day working week?
Whatever happened to Ted Heath?
Well, I think he went down on his yacht, didn't
he,
Joan? I'm not quite sure. People working, they're working more and more and more, and it seems they're working for little as well, instead of more benefits. And at the end of the day, money's not everything.
Oh, definitely not.
Money's not everything. I know it's easy to say when you've got it. But try telling a young couple that are trying to get a mortgage or
Absolutely.
Trying to get a roof over their head, which they've got no chance now. Basically got no chance. Unless your mum and dad can lend you 50 grand, they've got no chance.
Yeah.
It's, we've got to look for another way. Another way instead of this.
But I think money, I think it's fantastic, and you know they've done studies, haven't they, to say there's a comfortable amount of money where you I think it's something like between 30 and 50 thousand, which is a lot of money really, in order that you all your basic needs are met and some, so that you have a very good quality of life. You're not up in the Beckham stratosphere or the Brangelina's stratosphere, but you all your, like I say, all your basic needs are met, and then beyond that it's harder to be happy. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because then you get into the realm of dreams, and your dreams can't necessarily be bought, can they?
No, that's for sure. You've got to have a good imagination. Maybe that it could be a good thing that's happening as well, because sons and daughters, where they're living longer now with their parents because they have to.
Yeah.
Maybe that's going to bring them together.
Do you think maybe not?
Take Europeans. Quite a lot of, you know, I've lived in all different places, and they've got their mothers and fathers,
yes.
their grandmothers and their grandfathers with them, and they all live under the same roof happily. And, you know, one can learn from the other. You know, the old can learn from the young can learn from the older person. And that's a lovely mix. We don't seem to mix that well.
No, I think,
you know, we
that's
just
how
touch
it works.
Hands and
we like the idea. You know, ideally, that's how it would work. It's not necessarily perhaps how it would always play out if we all lived on top of one another.
Yeah.
But I do agree, as a culture, we tend to move on and away, don't we?
Yeah.
To actually come quite far-flung places.
Well,
whereas,
we've always have done, haven't we?
Yeah.
We've always built our little ships and off we go.
But other cultures, they do retain this family And
it seems to be, yeah. But yeah, they do. They
so the
do,
old
in
and
a
the
sense.
Young are rubbing along together, yeah. And like you say, learning from the generations. And that sounds a perfect way of carrying on. But we've, as a nation, we just don't seem to embrace that way
well,
of doing
maybe
things.
We're being forced to now.
Now, yes.
Because of the climate. And so people are actually thinking, well, why do I need to move 200 miles away from mum and dad? Well, you know, that's if mum and dad still loves you,
yeah.
And they don't want you to go.
Yeah.
You know.
And if mum and dad can sustain you being there, whether
sure.
that's emotionally or financially,
yeah.
spatially, there's lots of considerations, aren't there?
There is, yeah.
And how prepared they are as a parent to let go and let you live there but lead your own life.
That's right. Well, you've just done a little thing. My daughter has just turned 18 and we're lucky because we've got quite a nice house and she's just moved downstairs to her own little self-contained flat now.
Oh, well, that's ideal.
But she keeps coming up every day still using the kitchen.
Of course.
So it's taken her a long time to actually go down them stairs.
Raiding the fridge.
I know.
And does that cause ructions?
No, it's quite sweet, really, because kiddies that have been brought up here on the island, they've got a privileged life.
Very much so, yeah.
My God, they've got a privileged life. I mean, there's a difference between brought up and dragged up.
Yeah.
I think I was a little bit dragged up, I think, don't you know what I mean?
I think it's here where you've got the beach, haven't you? And you've got this natural beauty.
Yes, you have.
That
yeah.
surrounds you that you can land up taking for granted.
Yeah.
But perhaps, like us, where we're Oveners, we're from London and Brighton, and we do a pre-show, so we're from quite urban places. So to be here, I always think it's an absolute privilege.
Oh, every day. When I wake up and have a look out my window and see that beautiful sea, it is a privilege.
So you've got a sea view from where you are.
I'm very, very lucky.
And where are you over at Ventnor?
I'm over in Old Ventnor.
Ventnor.
Old Ventnor, which is a beautiful town.
And yeah. Have you always lived there on the island?
No. I've lived in Bembridge. Lived there for a year.
That's a very different feel to Ventnor, isn't it?
Yeah. It was a bit nose-uppy, if you know what I mean. Bembridge, it was quite a little bit snobby, but it was quite nice. East Cowes, I stayed there for a few weeks. That was just dead. I mean, I think it's trying to get up on its
yes.
feet now with the new marina and everything. And I lived in Wootton. Yeah, that was a nice...
Yeah, that's very beautiful.
Yeah,
that's
lived got in a holiday camp there.
Yeah, that's got a feeling all of its own there, hasn't it?
It has.
It's quite otherworldly.
Yeah, that was quite nice. Until I landed in Ventnor. Only because it was cheap, Joan.
But it's also very arty, isn't
it?
It
is now.
It's got a real feel
yeah.
there.
Well, no, it's not just now, is it? Because it goes back, doesn't it?
Of
Ventnor
course.
Bond Church goes back to Dickens,
yes.
was around the corner, Karl
yes.
Marx came. I did find out that right next door to me, Gandhi even stayed there.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is bloody incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, use that word again. Sorry.
Amazing.
Cut that one out. So, quite a history.
Yeah.
Quite a history. And all the Bryans, Lord Bryan and...
Byron.
Byron,
yes.
That's the one here, and they were all down. They all came over for a bit of relaxation.
Alfred Lord Tennyson.
Yes,
yeah.
Of course, yeah. So.
And now that tradition has carried on with the Ventnor Fringe Festival, which is growing every year, isn't it?
Oh, they're doing fantastic.
Oh, yeah, wonderful.
Absolutely fantastic, yeah.
And when you're around Ventnor at that time, I was performing there, but you've got this lovely atmosphere. It's bigger than a village, but everybody seems to know each other. Everybody's so friendly and warm, and
yeah, it's a buzz.
And everybody's batting for each and every one. Everybody's
batting
everyone else, which is lovely. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be this kind of dog eat dog competitive spirit.
No,
it seems a genuine that they respect that everybody's talent is slightly different, and just give you the space to get on with it.
That's for sure, especially at one of John's dues, Joan.
Yeah, John Armstrong. Yeah, so he does, about once a month on a Friday.
That's right, yeah.
And the Ventnor Exchange.
I can never pronounce it because I wish people
would... Corduroys?
Corduroys. I mean, Corduroys, I can't even pronounce it. I can't even get that mouth movement.
Corduroys.
Corduroys.
Just think of a pair of trousers.
Oh, corduroys.
Corduroys.
Cheers, Joan. I knew there'd be an easier way.
There you go. And I mean, and that's always such an interesting night, isn't it?
Yes.
John likes to pull together a very eclectic bill, doesn't he?
Yeah. He lets people have the stage, those that need it. It's raw, which gives it something which is unique and rawness.
When I first went, a lot of it went over my head. I didn't understand it at all.
You and me both.
And then I kept going and going, and the more I heard and the more I watched, the more I listened. So it's going back to that listening thing again.
Yes, it is, yeah.
The more I really paid attention, the more I loved it.
Yeah.
And however obscure it seemed to me at first, when I came away, it always got me thinking.
Yeah.
And something that can drill into your brain and get you thinking on your drive home and the next day and the next day and questioning, you know, what you'd thought initially. I think that there's something very special about that.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing to do is to listen. I have to remind myself every day about the blocks to listen. I've got lots of blocks to listen.
Go on, then. What are your blocks?
Read a couple of these out. All right. Comparing. You are remembering your story and not hearing theirs. Mind reading, jumping to conclusions as to the outcome, finishing sentences, filtering, acting on or reacting to only those pieces of information that appeal to you or you can cope with, judging, negative attitudes, deciding what sort of person they are because of their appearance, etc. Dreaming, thinking about your shopping, what happened to a friend, etc. Advising. Often people do not want answers to their problems until they've got it off their chest. Some people never want answers. Sparring. Trying to be one up. Jumping in with witty remarks, etc. I'm very guilty of that myself, Joan. Being right. When you're sure you're right, you're not hearing the other person's point of view. Derailing. Trying to change the subject. Divert their attention. Pacitating. Is that pacitating? I'm terrible.
Pacifying? Placating.
Placating. Trying to make things right. Smoothing words. It'll be all right in the long run, etc. I have to keep reminding myself all the time.
They're very...
how to listen.
I think we're all guilty of those, aren't we?
Of course we are. There's an art.
Yes.
There is a bloody art in... word again. Sorry, folks.
Active listening.
Active listening. And it is hard. I have to... you know... it's so easy to be distracted, especially these days. These days where everything is instant. No matter any question you can ask me, I can go... I don't even have to type it. I just talk it into Google. The
and
answer comes up.
An answer. Might not be the right one.
Exactly. But everything's entertained. You know, it's... to be without it all, I suppose. But then again, you can just... It's like mindfulness. It shouldn't be mindfulness. It should be mindlessness, shouldn't it? Because your mind shouldn't be full of things. So it only takes a second or 2 seconds to meditate. You don't have to spend hours doing it, going to these meditation courses. Just got to think to yourself, take a breath in, take a breath out. That's it. You've done your meditation for the day. If we can all do that, it'd be a great thing.
Taking a step back, and just consider. I think it's considering other people, isn't it? But it's so much easier said than done, because we're all busy, or we all think we're so busy, and we're all basically thinking of ourselves and what we're going to be saying next and doing next. It's very hard to consider the other person.
Of course it is, especially when you're just about to go on. Yes. I don't hear anything. I mean, my biggest thing
on stage
last week was all I was worried about: shall I stand up or sit down? That's all I could think about.
But it didn't come across. You came across so natural.
Yeah, I just thought I rushed it and everything.
You were brilliant.
I was terrible.
But I think it's because you think you were terrible that you were so good. Had you gone up there and thought you'd nailed it.
I've got that £20 for you later.
Thank you very much. Can we make it 40? No, I think that's like anything creative. You've got to have that self-doubt to make you even better at it. I think anybody that's complacent thinks they've got it. They probably haven't.
Time to give up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Dave, it's been an absolute joy, Dave King.
It's always good to talk about yourself, John.
No, thanks.
It's great.
A pleasure.
It's great. It's great.
And thank everybody for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it and look forward to talking to you again very soon. Take care. Enjoy the lovely island and stay safe. Bye bye now.
www.vectisradio.com.